From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we look at the growing gap between the haves and the have-nots.
The American economy is well more than twice as big as it was in 1973. But the average man who works full-time earns less now.
Plus, Thanksgiving week. For many, it means more than turkey and football. It means shopping at all sorts of weird hours.
So if we say we'll start at 12, people are like, oh my God, we can go to that store at 12. It's like little children going to the zoo at midnight.
There's so little excitement, I think, with online buying. Like, I'm happy to buy diapers online.
And old Islam in Detroit, rediscovering the Muslim American past.
The mosque very much functioned like the ethnic churches in the neighborhood did, and people even referred to it as our church.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Some of America's oldest and most diverse Muslim communities are in Detroit. But how did that come to be and why? I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, the long history of Islam in Detroit. But first, more and more economists are telling us the gap between the haves and have-nots in America is getting wider as the rich keep getting richer. Michigan State University economics professor Charlie Ballard joins us. It's always good to have you with us, Charlie.
Thanks, Cindy. Glad to be with you.
We hear two terms used, income inequality and wealth inequality. Those shouldn't be used interchangeably, should they?
No, they're related, and the trends in them have been similar. But income is how much money you make in a year. Typically, most households get most of their income from their wages and salaries, but then there's also interest and dividends and Social Security and other things like that. That's income, and it has been income inequality has been rising since the 1970s, very substantially in the United States. Wealth is, at any moment in time, what's the value of the stuff that you own? Mm. And that's, for a lot of people, it's equity in their home. There's also stocks and bonds and privately owned businesses and things like that. Wealth has also been distributed more unequally since the 1970s, but wealth has always been way, way, way more unequal than income. The bottom half of households basically have no wealth at all. They're living from paycheck to paycheck, whereas the bottom half of households do have income, even though some of them don't have a whole lot of income.
Looking at inequality in wealth, we found a recent piece in The Economist declares that this wealth inequality in America is approaching levels that we haven't seen since before the crash of 1929.
Yes, and there's a new research paper by Emmanuel Saez and Gabriel Zucman, two prominent economists, and they use a variety of methods to try to measure wealth inequality, and they're suggesting that we're wealth inequality reduced in the middle of the 20th century quite a bit, and the middle class did better. But in the last 40 years, both for income and for wealth, most of the gains have been at the top. And so now we have a situation where the top one-tenth of 1% of households have about the same amount of wealth as the bottom 90%. And that is a phenomenally unequal distribution of wealth.
And that is because?
Well, there are a bunch of reasons. One of them has to do with public policy. We have dramatically reduced our taxes on those at the top. You've heard Warren Buffett's comment that his tax rate is lower than his secretary's, even though he's one of the richest people in the world. We have lower tax rates on dividends and interest and capital gains than we have on ordinary income from working at a job. The estate tax, which is a tax on people's the wealthiest individuals when they die. The estate tax has been reduced greatly in the last few decades. And so we've had a policy decision to tax those at the bottom more and those at the top less. And that has predictable effects. There are other things, certainly the stock market. When stocks go up, most of the benefit of that goes to a relatively small number of people.
And then income inequality. In your recent study on income inequality, looked at changes in the distribution of household income in Michigan from 1976 till 2008. What'd you find?
Well, we found that Michigan, like most places, has had an increase in income inequality. Most regions of the country has had higher income inequality. There, the story is not so much with stocks and bonds as it is with increasing labor income inequality. That is to say, the high income, the high wage earners have pulled away from the middle class wage earners. Middle class really hasn't pulled away from the bottom. But the top has done very well all across the country. And Michigan, compared to other states, is sort of middle of the pack in terms of income inequality. We're not the most unequal. We're not the least. But we have, like most regions of the country, we in Michigan have seen a very substantial increase in the gap between those at the top and those at the bottom. Since the 1970s, that's when it really turned around, middle to late 1970s. And by the early 1980s, these trends toward greater inequality were really in high gear.
And we're seeing that kind of correspond to Michigan's manufacturing history, aren't we?
That's a big part of it, because our manufacturing economy in the middle of the 20th century really did an amazing job of providing middle class and even upper middle class standard of living for factory workers, something that is historically very unusual. But as you know, the manufacturing economy has had a really tough time in the last several decades, and that has one of the effects of that is that the middle class, especially in places like Michigan, have not done as well as those at the top.
So here's the situation. What you just stated, the middle class is not faring as well. And what needs to happen to boost that up and narrow that gap?
Well, I think there are a lot of things that could happen. The one that I put at the top of the list is to improve the education and skills of our workers, because having an education and having skill that you can bring to your employer, that's the number one ticket to a middle class or better standard of living. And Michigan, unfortunately, has lagged behind the national average in the fraction of our population who have a bachelor's degree or more, and also our K-12 system. When you compare our level of achievement for our K-12 students, it often ranks 30th or 35th among the 50 states. So one of the big changes of the last 40 years has been that those with only a high school diploma haven't done very well. If you're a high school dropout, it's been a terrible time. But if you have some college, and especially if you have at least a bachelor's degree, you've done better. And so that's why I think emphasis on education is really job number one if we want to strengthen the middle class in Michigan.
You and I have had this discussion a lot on Stateside.
Well, it was true the last time we talked, and it's still true now.
Where do you see America and Michigan going, Charlie, in terms of both income and wealth inequality? Just is the gap going to keep widening?
Well, I wish that I could see signs of it stopping widening. But right now, there is not a whole lot of evidence to suggest that that's going to happen. In fact, much of the policy debate, there are lots of people who are in elected office or running for elected office who would apparently be comfortable with a wider gap between the haves and the have-nots, because there are a lot of folks who are pressing for dramatically lower taxes on those at the top. That's one of many policies. It is, I think, quite possible that we'll have further steps toward rewarding those at the top and maybe not rewarding those in the middle in terms of what our political system is going for. Financial deregulation, for instance, was fabulous for a relatively small number of folks in Wall Street and big banks. not so good for the rest of the country as it helped contribute to the financial crisis. But now there is a great deal of pressure to go back to a very unregulated financial system. So I see a lot of folks pushing very hard for increased inequality, basically saying even after this historically unprecedented increase in income inequality, that's not enough. We need to go further. I respectfully disagree with that, but it's very controversial.
Well, it almost seems to smack of, I don't know, 18th century Europe.
Well, you know, that's one of the reasons why I am concerned about inequality when it runs up. Because if you look at the revolutions that racked Europe in the 17th and 18th century and even in the 20th century, a lot of that was driven by discontent among those, the great mass of the population that saw that they weren't getting much out of the changes in the economy. You know, there is the danger of fraying at the social fabric. The longer we go with ordinary citizens feeling like they are sort of left out. You know, here's an amazing statistic. The American economy is well more than twice as big as it was in 1973. But the average man who works full-time earns less now, if you adjust for inflation, than in 1973. So that's a very, very long period. And if the average guy isn't doing any better, and if the economy is twice as big, that means that those at the top are doing quite well.
Michigan State University economist Charles Ballard, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. For many of us, this week is about giving thanks. For others, it's all about the deals. The holiday shopping crush traditionally began at the crack of dawn on Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. But more and more retailers are deciding to throw the doors open and let America start spending on Thanksgiving Day itself. Scott Rick is a marketing professor from the University of Michigan. He's joined by Aradhana Krishna, the Dwight F. Benton Professor of Marketing. She's also director of the Sensory Marketing Laboratory. Good to have you both with us.
Thanks for having us.
You know, Aradhana, there is something that's kind of frankly appalling about seeing video of crowds surging in as a door gets opened and knocking each other over for a cheap price on a DVD player. Why aren't these people home shopping at the same retailer online?
You know, this is a very interesting question. So much of the retail experience is now moving online. I mean, I feel with Thanksgiving, there are two different purposes. You know, one is, of course, getting a deal. And the other, it's become this tradition that you go out and shop with your family. So the shopping with the family is typically done in a physical store. But in terms of getting the deal, you can also get it online. But I actually see lots of problems there and lots of differences from the physical shopping, both from a psychological and a sensory perspective. So firstly, there is this, you know, perceived lack of control in the online experience. So the sale opens. So let's say the online store starts giving the sale at 9 a.m. and then people try to log in and they can't log in. Then they try again. They can't log in. They try again. And they just don't know when they'll be able to log in or whether they'll be able to log in, which is extremely different from the physical experience. So in the physical experience, you can be standing in line. You can be standing in line for 2 hours. You can be standing in line in the middle of the night, but you know the door will open. You know when the door will open. So you have this sense of, at least some sense of control that, yes, the doors will open. Yes, I will get in.
What kind of marketing tactics do you see retailers using at this time in particular to really fire up our desire to get out there and shop, whether we're clicking on our, you know, with our mouse or standing in line? Some folks are in line starting at the beginning of the week to be there for when they open on Thursday or Friday.
You know, so this is something which has always bothered me, and I've written about this earlier. Very often, retailers use a limited offer. So they'll have, you know, the first 500 people get something at an amazingly low price, you know, a flat screen CV for $50.
The door buster.
The door opens. So clearly they are doing this to create a sense of excitement, and they want more people coming in and you know, only the first, well, let's say they promised it to 100 people will get it, but another 500 people will be coming into the store and buying other things. So there's a positive and a negative side to this. It's very positive for the retailer in the sense they drive these throngs in. But in terms of traffic control, as Scott said, so people are just rushing in to get to that point to get that particular deal. So that's something which, you know, I've written about it earlier and said, you know, like if they do something like this, there needs to be some crowd control, or maybe there needs to be a rain check for the people coming in so they're not running in over there. So clearly that doesn't happen online. But on the other hand, if you look at the flip side, and I think about this as an extrinsic and an intrinsic sense of excitement. So, you know, so when you're buying something, you're excited from within. But there's also this excitement from outside. So let's say you're in the physical environment and you rush in to get that flat screen and you score. So then you feel very victorious, and you feel more victorious if you beat out 1,000 people, because there is this human tendency to feel it's like a competition. I beat out so many people. Whereas online, you don't see those thousands of people you're beating out. So the sense of excitement, the same sense of excitement, the extrinsic driver of excitement is not there.
I'm speaking with University of Michigan marketing professors Aradhana Krishna and Scott Rick as we look at the shopping behaviors behind Black Friday and increasingly now Black Thursday as more stores open for Thanksgiving Day. Scott, you've actually studied brain images of people as they make shopping decisions. What do you find? What's going on?
Well, we found evidence for – the question was, what stops people? Why aren't we just spending like crazy? Because – there's all kinds of evidence saying that we can't think about prices in terms of what we're giving up later, which is what we kind of should be doing. And so we are looking for emotional underpinnings of buy or don't buy decisions. And we found evidence for neural evidence for a so-called pain of paying, that the more psychological distress people experience, the same region that's responsive to someone being mean to you or making you smell something gross, the more active that was, the less likely you were a few seconds later to actually buy the good. And they were making real shopping decisions while having their brains imaged.
So spending money can cause a psychological distress?
And that can be a helpful thing. That can help to control you. But then some of my later work found that some people have too much of it and they're unhappy. Some people don't have enough and they're also not super happy.
Do you see differences when a buyer uses cash versus credit card versus debit card?
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence by now showing that people are much looser with credit than they are with cash, and there's so much to that. One is it's just less tangible to swipe a card than to physically hand over cash. Another reason is that a purchase might look tiny compared to a large credit limit than compared to the $30 that you have on you.
All sense of proportion.
That's right. And there's also just evidence that the logos themselves can create this craving. Studies have shown if you just prime people, show them credit card logos, they'll spend more with cash. So it's like smelling fresh cookies. So there's lots of reasons why credit cards can make people misbehave. Sadly, though, now credit cards are safer than cash or debit, so you have this tension.
In a sense of you can appeal a...
It's very easy to get that money back as opposed to debit or cash. It's just gone.
It is gone. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, have either of you seen any marketing tactics this year for Black Friday or more and more Black Thursday that especially impressed or especially appalled you just in terms of how retailers are trying to get us in? And we understand we need to have a lively economy. We need retail health. And so we get that. But I'm just wondering what you think as you watch the commercials and watch them trying to get us to come in.
So I think actually over the years I'm finding that the amount of time that stores are open for Black Friday have become longer and longer. So it's, you know, it's no longer Black Friday, we know that, but it's starting earlier. So it became Thursday and now it's becoming Wednesday. And I believe many stores this year are starting on Wednesday. And then it's going into Cyber Monday, which is not Cyber Monday anymore. It's become, you know, it starts like 5 days earlier. So it's become like a week of Black Friday. Then there are these, as I said before, the limited offers, so longer hours, and also there is this sense of let's start at a very eye-catching time. So it can be midnight. Let's start at midnight. So, you know, it's a different shopping experience. So if we say we'll start at 12, people are like, oh, my God, we can go to that store at 12. It used to open, you know, only during the day, but it's like a night shopping experience. It's like little children going to the zoo at midnight, you know. So it's like they're going to camp. So that's another thing. And then this year I'm also finding that in some stores, they've started doing things like giving free popcorn or giving free hot chocolate and having, you know, little photo booths inside. So to keep the excitement going and to keep the people there.
It's so true. There's so little excitement, I think, with online buying. Like, I'm happy to buy diapers online, but I still have a need to kind of touch and smell things. And, like I said, I don't really love the swarms of people, but it is fun. It's fun to be there. And I've actually done some work on retail therapy in defense of it, that it can help with certain things. But I still will be at the stores, even though I'm every day Cyber Monday to me. But I'll still be there because I want to see the toy and let the kid play with it. And is it taking?
Scott Rick is a marketing professor at the University of Michigan, and Aradhana Krishna is the Dwight F. Benton Professor of Marketing there, also the director of the Sensory Marketing Laboratory. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you.
Speramus meliora resurgit sineribus. In case your high school Latin was non-existent or very rusty, that means we hope for better things, it shall rise from the ashes. Father Gabriel Richard wrote those words after a tremendous fire in 1805, a fire that destroyed most of Detroit. Those words from that French-Canadian priest became the motto of the city— a city with a history filled with many different kinds of fires. Michael Jackman spells out this fiery history in his story for the Metro Times. What drew you to this topic?
Well, it was a special issue that we were all contributing to about fire, whether it be the state of fire today or arson. And as I began thinking about my knowledge of Detroit history, which is a pet subject of my own, I started thinking of all the instances in which fire sort of flares up in the city's history. And I don't think there's any other city that I know of that has quite the relationship with fire that Detroit does.
Well, you actually start your piece with what I thought was a really terrific image, and you ask us, as your readers, to imagine a time-lapse image of Detroit's 313-year history. What would we see?
Well, you'd see a city burning down, building itself up again, burning down again, and burning itself up when the fires rage out of control at several instances. Most famously in the Great Fire that's referenced in the city's flag. And I started to think, is there any city that has the image of itself on fire in its own flag?
Good point. And you point out in your story, as well as that big fire in 1805, that the late 1800s and early 1900s brought a lot of different blazes in the city. In fact, I never knew until I saw your story that the bridge to Belle Isle burned.
Yes. That's sort of a byproduct of just the enormous amount of lumber that was produced in the state of Michigan in the 19th century. Billions of board feet. Much of that went into building a city largely made of wood. And after the Great Fire that burned it completely to the ground, it's almost too tempting to ask fate to leave all those structures standing. The Great Opera House Fire of 1897, the Belle Isle Bridge Fire of 1915, this is a time when many of the city's streets were paved with wood and pitch and flammable, with people throwing lit cigars down on them all the time.
So the streets can burn.
The streets could literally catch fire in late 19th century Detroit.
Now, in your piece for the Metro Times, you look at other types of fires in Detroit's history, and some of those fires offer and illustrate progress and prosperity, and some of them illustrate racial divides and hatred. Let's start with the progress and prosperity view of fires. And you very rightly point to Detroit's days of the arsenal of democracy in World War II.
Yes, there's a great book by Harriet Arnold called The Dollmaker about a Southern family that moves up to Detroit in the 1940s for war work. And she describes this unearthly glow that'll be cast by the foundries that are running full tilt all night long. You know, you have the refineries and the factories that are burning off waste products on the top of their stacks. You have this city that is not only casting these machines in fire, but they're going to go somewhere else and in an act of war, set someplace else on fire. then there's the literal fire that powers Detroit's key contribution to the world, the automobile, which is literally powered by fire. You don't think about it often,
no.
But billions of controlled explosions are sending people coursing down the city's roads and freeways. So from the humble piston to the boiler to the foundry and refinery, you get this image of a city that has a very special relationship with fire.
And it's shown in the city's art.
It's right. It's referenced in the famous Detroit industry murals by Diego Rivera. And I would argue that the spirit of Detroit, he's holding something in his hand. It's sending out rays of light. Looks very much to me like a burning star.
Interesting. And then to the racial tensions. And I'd like you to take us back to before what you point out as the 12th Street riot. You tell us, fueled by race hatred, Detroit's fires were burning long before the smoke clouds of 1967. How far back, Michael?
Well, by the official record, 1863. In 1863, an unfortunate rumor that turned out to be unfounded set off a rather ugly riot in which the city's white residents sort of went marauding into the black section of town and burned down 30 buildings, leaving dozens of people homeless. Or you could also think about the race riot of 1943, which is much less discussed, where, again, rioting crowds of white people were pulling black motorists out of their automobiles, tipping them over on Woodward, and setting them on fire. We have a long and particularly ugly legacy of that in Detroit, and it's something that isn't much discussed, even though people will remember the fires of 1967, but the record seems to end there.
Yes, yes.
For probably reasons of convenience of conscience.
Having just cleared Halloween, we have to talk about Detroit's history of Devil's Night fires. I remember covering these in the 1990s, and you had people coming from all around the world to photograph Detroit firefighters as they raced from one blaze to the next on Devil's Night. And you point out the record was more than 800 fires on one night, October 30th, 1984. Now, this year's fire count, 93 fires over 3 days at the Halloween period, and that's the same as last year. Does it seem that that Devil's Night arson fest has finally come to an end?
It seems that way. You certainly have community groups and a number of vigilant volunteers out there to make sure that the vacants don't get burned, that they aren't leaving behind these burned-out eyesores that then have to be torn down. As I understand it, the 4th of July now exceeds Devil's Night in the amount of fires in the city of Detroit. But for those who remember it in the 1980s, it was sort of an eerie night where you could smell the smoke of all the fires burning from just almost any point in the city. When you have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of individual fires, it's also very easy to perhaps commit a bit of insurance fraud or yeah. settle a score with an unwanted neighbor and get off scot-free, perhaps. So that was a very strange time. Now the people who are watching have more or less turned it into a community event where people come together to protect buildings, which is sort of interesting. Some good things do come out of the fires.
You do point that out. Good things can come in the aftermath of a fire.
That's right. For instance, after the Great Fire that touches off the 19th century in Detroit, you have Judge Augustus Woodward is able to implement his fanciful street grid plan inspired by L'Enfant's design for Washington. In the wake of the 1863 fire and riot, Detroit reacts by forming a police force. So there are movements in the direction of progress that come out of it, and well, maybe what Richard wrote is true. If we hope for better things, we will rise again from the ashes.
And how do you think Detroit will rise from the ashes of the bankruptcy and the crisis that it's been going through?
Well, it's hard to say exactly what's going to happen. I suppose that, like many people, I would like my own crystal ball to gaze into. But certainly, it doesn't hurt that that phoenix-like nature is embedded right within the city's motto and its flag. And we would hope that it would come out and build itself up again.
Michael, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Michael Jackman is managing editor of Detroit's Metro Times, and his story is Motor City Burning. No city has fire flaring up in its history quite like Detroit. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is widely accepted Michigan has the largest Muslim population in the U.S. How did that come to be? When did those early Muslim settlers come to Michigan? Where'd they come from? And why Michigan? My next guest tackles these and many more questions in her new book, Old Islam in Detroit, Rediscovering the Muslim American Past. Sally Howell is an assistant professor of history and of Arab American studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. Welcome, Sally.
Great to be here. Thank you, Cynthia.
You say in your book, the early period of Muslim history in this country, in your words, is widely unknown to the American public and to Muslim Americans themselves. Why is this?
Well, it's because the Muslim community is one that keeps reinventing itself. And in the process of reinventing itself, very often the earlier history, the past, tends to be sort of neglected or forgotten or overwritten. And that's, in fact, as much the subject of my book as is the history itself, right? So why is it that things have been forgotten? And it's largely due to the fact that when new people come to America and when new people come to Islam as converts, they very often have this sense that what they're doing is something sort of new and that America is somehow a place that is new to Islam. Right. So the fact that there are these American Muslims who have been here for a while, who've already established themselves, who are very comfortable and at home in America, that brushes up against what they think Islam is or what they think America is.
So there's all these forces at play.
All these forces at play.
Give us that sense of history. And when did Muslims first make their way to America in an appreciable number?
There are sort of two phases. The first phase was the early history of the United States, you know, the colonial era, the pre-national period, and the pre-Civil War period, when many Muslims, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, perhaps even more than that, came as slaves. A lot of the Muslims who came in from West Africa, in particular, were Muslim. So they brought Islam with them. Many of them tried to practice Islam, and there are wonderful records of their experience. But because of slavery and because it was difficult for people to, they didn't have the freedom to practice their religion, to marry co-religionists, to establish themselves, right? Islam, like the other religions that Africans brought with them, were mostly sort of killed off, basically, by the slave experience. But the second phase was started really in the late 19th, early 20th century, when immigrants started coming from what was the Ottoman Empire. They came from places like Albania and Bosnia. They came from Syria and Lebanon. They came from really Turkey itself, right? The country that is now Turkey. And these people came to work and they followed other immigrants from that period. And many of them made their way to Detroit, especially after the $5 work day from Henry Ford. And in fact, the first mosque that was built as a mosque in the United States of America was built one block away from the entrance of that Highland Park factory. It was called the Muslim Mosque of Highland Park. And it was created by Arabs, by Turks, by a few South Asians who worked together to establish Islam in Michigan.
So Michigan became the beacon, in a sense, because of Henry Ford's factories.
Exactly. I mean, there were Muslims in New York, there were Muslims in Chicago, but Detroit was really seen as being a center. All the missionaries came here, and a lot of the immigrants came here, too, because it had a reputation for being a Muslim space.
And when you say a reputation, a Muslim space, meaning welcoming, non-judgmental?
Well, it wasn't judgmental in the way people are judgmental today. There were stereotypes that Americans had about Muslims. In this period, in the teens and the 20s, a lot of Americans sort of thought of Islam, they associated it very much with polygamy, and they saw polygamy as being very problematic. So in fact, when you came to America in the period, you had to forswear polygamy. But they also associated it with the Armenian genocide. So if you were coming from Syria or places like that, people talked quite a bit about the Armenian genocide and represented Islam as being a faith that was sort of run by a tyrant, the caliph, and that Muslims were somehow anti-democratic in their practices and things like this. So a lot of the stereotypes that we hear today, we also heard back then, but in a different way, in a different way. And the Muslims who were here were very active in trying to counter those stereotypes. Perhaps their most successful way of doing so was just to establish communities.
Begin living. I'm speaking with Sally Howell, who's an assistant professor of history and Arab American studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. Her new book is Old Islam in Detroit, Rediscovering the Muslim American Past. As the 20th century wore on and more immigrants came, I'm wondering how Muslim identity changed as people came in and became a part of life in Detroit and in Southeast Michigan.
Again, there were different phases. In the early period, I think people were, like most immigrant communities are, very committed still to their homelands. And so we saw a lot of political activism in the teens and in the 20s in particular, where people from Africa, people from South Asia, people from the Middle East came together and they saw Islam as a means to counter the colonialism that was taking place in their homeland. So they fought against colonialism in Africa and Asia and the Middle East in particular. And there was a period when that was their focus. But you also had people who began bringing families here, especially the Syrian community brought their families, the Lebanese, Arab, Syrian community. And once you have American children, your goal really changes. Suddenly your focus is no longer on things overseas. It's on how are you going to raise these kids as Muslims? How are you going to find them Muslim partners to marry? Things like this. Your kids are going to the public schools. There's no greater engine of Americanization than the public schools. And as people start to feel more at home here, they really settle in. And they developed mosques. In particular, some of the oldest mosques in Michigan were located in the south end of Dearborn, which is today where the oldest mosque in Michigan still exists, the American Muslim Society. And it's a very large mosque today, mostly a Yemeni mosque with thousands of people who come for Friday prayer, a very active, large mosque. But it was started by a small group of families who just wanted a place to teach their kids Arabic. And it started off as a one room. They didn't have enough money to build a whole building, so they just built like a square box. Everybody referred to it as the basement because it was halfway underground. And they worshiped there for about 20 years until they could add on a second floor and make it more of a formal mosque. But that mosque was, you know, it fit into a neighborhood. It fit into the landscape of the neighborhood very much in the same way that the other immigrants who lived in that neighborhood, the Romanians, the Italians, the Poles, all these groups had their own churches. And people went to them on Sunday and people started going to the mosque on Sunday because everybody worked on Friday. You couldn't necessarily get off work for Friday prayer. So people prayed on Sunday. The mosque very much functioned like the ethnic churches in the neighborhood did, and people even referred to it as our church. And other ethnic kids from the neighborhood would go to the mosque and eat when there was a meal at the mosque, and the Arab kids would go to the churches and eat when there was a meal at those churches. And it was the center of the social life of the community.
And then as new immigrants would come from the Middle East, would they look at the long-timers a bit askance?
Well, yeah. So, and this happened over and over again.
Yes.
So at the Dix Mosque in particular, there's a famous incident that took place there in the 1970s. So by the 1970s, again, this was just an American congregation. Probably the majority of the people who actually worshiped there were born in the U.S. And there were grandkids who were being raised in the mosque. And they had dances and sock hops at the mosque, right? The whole point of the mosque was to keep the community together. This was before Dearborn was an Arab town like it is today, where you could buy Arabic food in any grocery store, and there are tons of restaurants, and there are banquet facilities and things like this. The mosque was it for the community, and so people had to have their weddings in the mosque and their funerals in the mosque and their graduation celebrations in the mosque and things like this. And when people came from the Middle East, they would look at this mosque and say, wow, you know, we've never seen dances at a mosque before. Dances shouldn't be in a mosque. Or what are all these women doing here? There are many, many women in the mosque. They don't even have their heads covered. And also the people who started arriving, especially in the 1960s and 70s, they were politicized in a different period, right? They grew up in a Middle East that had been affected to a great extent by the Cold War, right? So there was a conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union, and their countries were all caught up in this. Many of them came from dictatorships and countries that had been sort of propped up by the United States, and they were tended to not be very friendly to Zionism. Mm-hmm. They were all very supportive of Palestinian rights. And this is, of course, after the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, which was traumatic for the region, to say the least. And so people came here and they felt a little bit at odds with America. Mm-hmm. And they had a much more conservative form of Islam they were practicing, a more modernist, a more rational type of Islam, less based just on experience and more based on interpretation and knowledge and things like this. And they were trying to live sort of very much as upright Muslims. And they came to America.
Letter of the law.
Letter of the law. And they came and they saw these American Muslims, the women with their heads uncovered, dances in the mosques, all these things that to them just looked American. They didn't look Muslim. Mm. And so they became concerned and they basically organized a coup, took over the board, took over the mosque, you know, told the women they had to cover their hair and put in their own Sunday school teachers and things like this. And this was, of course, traumatic for the founders of the mosque.
Basically being called out by newcomers.
Being called out and they felt like they were kicked out, too.
Yes.
So they went and started a new mosque. It wound up okay. But But the thing about this is we kind of are familiar with this happening in the 1960s and 70s. It kind of goes back further in time. So there's an imam who came to Detroit in the 1940s, right? And he wasn't that different in the terms of the way he had been raised from the people around him. He was invited by a mosque, another mosque, which was right down the street from the Dix Mosque, that was called Hashemi Hall. And he was invited to be the imam of Hashemi Hall. And one of the first things he did when he got there was Hashemi Hall was in a renovated bank building. It wasn't in a building that looked like a mosque, right? And he went in and he thought that was inadequate. And the first event he held in the mosque, he put a prayer rug down on the floor. And he said, "I now declare this a mosque," and had a prayer in it. Well, the mosque had been a mosque for 12 years before he got there, you know. Yeah. So, and he also, a few weeks later, he had another party to create a Muslim school. And there was already a Muslim school there. So he actually got kicked out of town.
Oh, right.
The people who built that institution said, "Hey, wait a minute. We don't need you to tell us that we're not enough of a mosque." You know, he eventually came back and he was the founder of the Islamic Center of America, the very large mosque that many people in Michigan are aware of that's on Ford Road. So there's, you know, there was a lot of push and pull. But together, people have created this very large, dynamic Muslim community that we see today.
What about the other side of the coin? Spell out for us the ways that the Muslim community has changed Southeast Michigan.
Well, so in the first place, they've just made it a more dynamic community in terms of faith, right? And you can practice Islam now in Detroit without even entering a mosque, right? There's halal food everywhere. Many of the public school systems close on Islamic holidays. Like I said, there are banquet halls. There is just a public space here that is open to Muslims and has been shaped by Muslims. So that's sort of the religious side of it. Now, obviously, Muslims have been here for 100 years or more now, and so there are people who helped build the cars. There are the people who helped engineer the cars. There are many Muslims who helped lay out the city, build the apartment buildings and all the housing in the city. We are, you know, the Arab community is famous for running the small groceries in the city for over 100 years. Different people have done it over time. Now the Lebanese have a sort of a monopoly on the gas station business in Detroit, you know. But Muslim Americans from a whole wide array of backgrounds. I mean, if you go to the mosques outside Hamtramck in the summertime, you see their parking lots filled with ice cream trucks. Right. So they're newly arrived people who are selling ice cream. That's the way they're getting their start. And then there are doctors and lawyers and engineers and people who run, you know, some of the state's biggest companies. And, you know, Muslims are running more and more for public office. So Muslims are just totally a part of the fabric of Michigan now.
Sally, what drew you to this field? You're an assistant professor of history and Arab American studies. You are not Muslim.
Not Arab either.
Yeah. What drew you to this field?
Well, I first came to Michigan when I was right out of college, and I had worked briefly in Washington with an Arab American organization there, and they recommended me to Ishmael Ahmed, who was the director of Access at the time, and I was looking for a job. I was sort of between things, and Ish hired me to be the arts director at Access. And I will say, I really didn't know very much about local history or about, you know, Michigan history, Arab American history. And the thing that struck me about Dearborn, the thing that struck me that made it exotic and interesting to me and worthy of my real focus and attention wasn't the Arabness of Dearborn. I had lived in the Middle East before and done research there and gone to school there. So that it wasn't the Arabness. It was the working class nature of the city. I was just fascinated. I was right there working in the shadow of the Rouge plant. And in a neighborhood where, you know, where the UAW was really born in many ways. And it was those stories, right? And it was, of course, Arab Americans who were introducing me to this history. So that's really what got me started.
To many around around Michigan and around the world, the face of Islam now is the man, for example, dubbed Jihadi John, the ISIS killer who's been front and center in these recent beheading videos. How do you reconcile the Islam that you have come to know through working and studying with the jihadist view that the world is sees and is horrified by?
I can't reconcile those. They have nothing in common with one another. The people I work with in Michigan are, I mean, they're believing people. They're committed to their faith. They want to keep their faith alive and make it viable and vibrant and attractive to the next generation. That's their mission. That's their goal. They're also Americans, completely and fully, and they want to make our society a better place. as well for the next generation. And they're working very hard to do that on a whole variety of nonprofit organizations and charities that are trying to reinvent the city and things like that. But this this fanaticism that we see is a product of generations of underinvestment or misguided investment in the region by our government, by other governments. What we've imported or exported to the Middle East more than anything is our technologies of war. The experience of military occupation and violence there has traumatized people, clearly. And, yeah, I can't justify what people are doing. I wouldn't begin to. And I can't understand it, even as a person. But it's there. But it has so little to do with the people I work with that I just don't even – I don't need to be a specialist on those things, mm-hmm, right? Those mm-hmm. those are not what the people here in Michigan are about.
But to know that people who are not Muslim, they're looking at that and they immediately, you know that, are covering the entire community with that terrible blanket.
Yeah, well, that's part of what also makes it a challenge to be a Muslim American, right? So you're not just doing what other immigrant populations or other convert populations do, which is set about trying to establish yourself. You're establishing yourself with this stigma on your back and with this, you know, everyone's afraid of you. The government is spying on the community. It's really a cloud that hangs over people. And there's not a thing that takes place in the community that doesn't take place in relation to that cloud, right? It's so pervasive.
Through that filter,
the
yeah.
stereotypes. I mean, most of the students I teach at U of M Dearborn in my Arab American classes are Muslim Americans, right? And they understand that that what they do, if you're from a small minority community like this, every person represents the community, right? Everything you do somehow represents your community. You're not free to just go off and make mistakes. Whatever mistakes you make reflect back on the community. And this is a real burden and responsibility for people to have to bear, especially young people. But again, like I said, the way that Muslims are sort of coping with this is just to really invest in this society, right? To invest publicly, to, you know, try and make sure that other Americans can see or they want to be visible, right? They can't be invisible. In the past, they might have chosen to be invisible. They can't be invisible anymore. So they want to be visible with all the positive things they're doing. That's really the only thing they can do to counter this.
Sally Howell is an assistant professor of history and Arab American studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. Her new book is Old Islam in Detroit, Rediscovering the Muslim American Past. Pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Cindy.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ali Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark, and today's engineer was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, Annie Norris, and Katrina Schaefer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.